Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
There we go. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. I'm Joe Garofoli, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle and the San Francisco Chronicle's politics blog, and tonight we're here with Andy Bichlbaum. He is one of the Yes Men. Now, the Yes Men are known for posing as corporate or government spokespeople and audaciously making speeches and creating phony press releases and pitching ridiculous ideas. And now we're here broadcasting from San Francisco, but we're going to talk a little bit, give you a little background on these guys. And now we love all kinds of political activism here. This is nearly every day on the streets here. We have street protests ranging from Code Pink to Critical Mass. But the Yes Men take political theater and political activism to a new level. They impersonate officials of major corporations that they believe are doing evil, from Halliburton to Dow Chemical. Then somehow they get themselves invited to conferences or onto TV as representatives of that corporation. Now, your biggest coup probably was 2004. Andy went on to the BBC impersonating a Dow Chemical spokesman. He was there in the 20th anniversary of the horrible Union Carbide accident that has caused 25,000 deaths in Bhopal, India. It's the largest industrial accident in history in terms of human cost. Union Carbide settled the claims of the victims of the accident for roughly about, what, $500 a person? Mm. And now a few years before that, Dow had purchased Union Carbide, but they hadn't really done much to compensate the victims.
Not in India.
Not in India. Yeah. No, in the United States.
They had, yeah.
Now, Andy, as a Dow representative, went on the BBC and told the world, 300 million people or so, that Dow would give $12 billion to the victims of the Bhopal accident. Within about 20 minutes of this news breaking on the BBC, Dow's value dropped $2 billion. Now, there have been many other Yes Men political pranks over the years, many of them portrayed in their movie The Yes Men Fix the World, which is now out on DVD. They went to a conference on trade with Africa, impersonating an official with the World Trade Organization. They proposed, quote, full private stewardship of labor, which some may call slavery, correct? Yeah. Where the Western corporations would actually own their own African employees. The Yes Men also posed as the head of Exxon at a major oil conference in Canada recently. There they introduced a new fuel called Vivolium, and that is made from human flesh of the people who would be killed from global warming. They made candles made out of Vivolium, passed them around to the people at the conference, and had the conference attendees light them before you were escorted from the room. Yes.
Yeah, they had human hair in them, so they were pretty obviously
a good smell.
To them.
And then we'll in a bit, we'll talk about what the Yes Men are up to next, the Yes Lab, which will involve recruiting others like yourselves to join them in this kind of activism. And on this day, Goldman Sachs executives testified in Washington about their scheme to profit from the mortgage crisis. And their stock, Goldman Sachs stock, went up today. Mm-hmm. And on this, it's auspicious that we welcome Andy Bichlbaum to the Commonwealth Club. Welcome, Andy.
Thanks, Joe.
Now, your partner here, Mike Bonanno, he couldn't be here tonight because of the volcano in Iceland, correct?
Yeah.
Now, can you say for the record that the Yes Men had nothing to do to detonate the volcano? Is that accurate?
The fact that he's delayed, I think, proves that, we had nothing to do with it.
So before we get into the history of the Yes Men, you were a longtime San Francisco resident,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Yep.
And tell us, before we got into that, tell us a little bit about how you worked for Maxis, which made The Sims video game, but you got sick of your job and decided to play a prank there. This was very early in your activism days.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, I was one of the first couple of programmers on The Sims, actually, before it was really anything. But then they transferred me to a stupid game called SimCopter. And it wasn't terrible. It was just it wasn't terribly interesting to me either. And I had only ever lasted about 6 months at a job maximum, and this was already a year. So I figured it was time to move on. And also my boyfriend had left me, and they wouldn't give me time off to deal with that. You know, the game had to come first. So I just decided I wanted to leave the job, but I would do it in an interesting way. And so I put what I wanted to see in the world at the time, which was a lot of young men in swimsuits running around kissing me, into the game. So they would run around occasionally. They would just appear miraculously every once in a while and start kissing the pilot, kissing each other, kissing cops, everything. And but it would only happen occasionally. So the game was shipped to store shelves, 80,000 copies.
80,000.
And the next morning, the next day, my boss was playing the game with his daughter, and it happened. There were hundreds of guys in swimsuits kissing him and his daughter. And so I predictably enough got fired. And unpredictably, I was telling the story to a reporter friend, and he was so excited about it. He wrote an article, Steve Silberman for Wired, fantastic reporter besides this, not just because of this. But he wrote a great article about it, the Himcopter story. And it became a worldwide media story, to my total surprise. I hadn't really intended that. I just thought it would be funny and make people laugh. But it became this big, big story, and so I had to justify it. I had to explain that it was, you know, an act of activism, that I'd meant something by it. And then I thought, well, what if one did this on purpose, you know? I'd done very little to do this, to get a really big media story about an issue into the media, and so I started thinking of ways to do that. Kind of created a fictional corporation that specialized in anti-corporate sabotage, and pretended like I'd been paid by them. A couple friend was telling some. I tried to get reporters to believe it. They didn't believe it, but friends. I told some friends about the fiction, and they said, "Oh, you must hook up with this guy named Mike who did the Barbie Liberation Organization."
Now, tell folks who might not remember, don't know about the Barbie Liberation. This is a classic political cultural prank.
Yeah, that was in 1993, and Mattel had just produced talking G.I. Joe and Barbie dolls, dolls with voice boxes. And so the Barbie said, "I want to go shopping," or "math is hard." And the G.I. Joes said terrible things that you'd expect G.I. Joes to say. So Mike purchased a bunch of the dolls, switched their voice boxes, and put them back on store shelves, and released a video to news stations on behalf of the Barbies, who were revolting against Mattel, and claimed responsibility for it, the Barbie Liberation Organization. And it became a giant story. And it was an episode of The Simpsons, and everybody heard about it, including me. And so when my friends suggested that we meet and plot together, it was a really good idea, and we've been working together ever since.
And your activism was kind of forged here in San Francisco, working with ACT UP. Tell us a little bit about how that worked.
Well, I wasn't working with ACT UP. I was just really influenced by it. I mean, it was all around super powerful, effective movement that at the time was seen as outlaw. You know, it was like people were getting arrested all the time, making a lot of trouble, and it was tremendously effective and very creative and pesky and mischievous as well. And I think, you know, seeing that kind of activism and how effective it was and how fun it looked as well, I was just ready to jump when something presented itself.
Did you grow up in a political family or an activist family at all? Or you grew up in Arizona, right?
Yeah, I grew up in the suburbs.
Yeah.
So that's enough to turn anybody angry, mischievous, and political, I think.
Yeah. So tell us about your first, when you hooked up with Mike, how'd the Yes Men evolve from that?
Well, in 1999, November 99, thousands of people were headed to Seattle to protest the World Trade Organization, which represented this idea that of free trade and free markets, and the idea that all you had to do was let the rich do whatever they wanted and things would work out great for everyone. That was the idea, and that actually remained the dominant idea. You didn't even question that until very recently, when it proved how stupid it is by itself, with a lot of help from activists. But in 1999, the WTO represented that idea, and everybody knew thousands of people were going to head to Seattle to cause some trouble, maybe break some windows. And we wanted to participate. We couldn't make it to Seattle, so we set up a fake website for the World Trade Organization that looked just like the real thing. It was at GATT.org. The WTO evolved out of something called the GATT. And the WTO did a strange thing. And our website was satirical. It made fun of the WTO. It just pushed it all the way. The same ideas that they had, it just took them and pushed them. And the WTO reacted by posting a press release about our site, calling it deplorable, saying we undermined their transparency. And nobody noticed that press release, so we did them a big... But so they wrote to us, first of all. They wrote to us saying, look what you've made us do, write a big press release about you, you terrible people. And we felt so ashamed that we sent their press release to thousands of journalists. And it got into the media. Some people wrote about it, not very many, but a few were amused by it, passed it around. It got into search engines as a result. And then when you would search on World Trade Organization, you would often enough stumble on our site. And so we started getting invitations to conferences intended for the WTO. We accepted.
And so did that sort of... How did you happen upon that then? Did you say, well, we'll just take these invitations and go with it?
No, it took us about 3 months. The first one we got took us 3 months to accept. We just didn't know what to do with it. It was for Mike Moore, who was the director general at the time. And so we sent it to Michael Moore. They were both roughly the same shape. And he didn't answer, so eventually we said, well, he can't come. Mike Moore can't make it, but we'll send a substitute. But it took really 3 months to get to that point where, it seemed obvious at that point.
And then so you went to this conference, and what happened there?
We proposed, in the name of the World Trade Organization, taking free markets all the way and privatizing democracy itself by establishing a market in people's votes. So instead of going through this complex campaign finance system, right, where corporations pay campaigns, which pay public relations agencies, which basically pay TV stations and so on, just pay the voters directly.
Just pay the voters.
Yeah, a little internet system, website, just pay the voters.
We're kind of going through that in California right now with Meg Whitman. She's she's the former head of eBay, and she's spent $60 million of her own money. She's a billionaire, and she's been on television all the time with her commercials and such, and she doesn't feel the need to engage with the media so often. And what do you think about that? That's kind of the extension of this almost.
Yeah. The influence of corporations on our private lives is enormous, and on public life... It's called lobbying, and corporations spend millions and millions and millions of dollars fooling us all the time, creating hoaxes on us. Something like 30% of the news we see on TV is actually packaged by corporations, of course, video news releases. And entities like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce spend, like the U.S. Chamber spends $400,000 every single day lobbying Congress and producing hoaxes for all of us, so that we'll vote against our real interests.
You recently had a little dust-up with the Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, tell us what happened there. You called a press conference at the National Press Club in Washington. That's the place where dozens of press conferences happen every week, and you were up there representing the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. You were there to talk about what? The climate change, correct?
Yeah. We did this with a group called the Avaaz Action Factory, who are these fantastic young people who are fighting for decent climate legislation. And the Chamber of Commerce is, of course, one of the villains in that. They were opposing any climate legislation, even the watered-down stupid version that there was, the cap and trade. So they thought, and we agreed, that it would be fun to speak for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, as they should be. So they set up a press conference at the National Press Club, announced it to the media, the local media.
How does that work? Can you just rent a room with the National Press Club and say, hey, we're the Chamber of Commerce? Or
I don't know. You'd have to ask them.
Okay.
I think so. I mean, I think they actually called it something slightly different, but I'm not quite sure. Basically, yeah. And then, you know, we sent out a press release announcing the thing. Mm-hmm. And announcing that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was taking a dramatically different position on climate change, the obvious position that they should. And then I got up on stage at the National Press Club with these reporters in the room and announced that we were going to support climate legislation and make it stronger, and called for a carbon tax, which would work a lot better than cap and trade. Said things like, you know, clean coal doesn't exist, that's a hoax, it's a lie, don't believe it. All these things that are just kind of obvious, but the U.S. Chamber would never, ever say. But it was so logical and such common sense that the reporters in the room just believed it and asked questions for a while.
And then something unusual happened in one of your stunts. The actual representative from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce interrupts your press conference.
Yeah, the head of public relations at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce got wind of this somehow, stormed in with his pencil still behind his ear, and
he was
announced.
Mad.
He was super mad.
Yeah,
he was livid. It was a bad Monday for him.
Yeah.
Really bad.
And he said, this man is a fraud. This is a fraudulent press conference.
Fraudulent, yes.
Fraudulent press conference. And he said, show me your business card.
Yeah.
That was his way of kind of calling you out.
Yeah. So I demanded to see his, you know, and he wouldn't show me his. And so, you know, we were there facing each other, demanding business cards, and, you know, I was saying, who are you? And he was saying, who are you? And it was just beautiful. It was like made for TV.
Since when does a business card determine someone's identity? I mean, you can get those at the Kinko's. I mean,
you
print them out on your own computer.
You do, actually.
Yeah, but so he was demanding to see you, and you had to kind of a stalemate there for a while.
Yeah.
And then he stormed off. And
well, he got to the bottom of it by getting me to admit that I was, to name my position.
That's right.
And I tried to tell him my position. I had just spoken, but then I said, well, I'm the assistant to the president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And he said, that's not true. This man is a fraud. And stormed out, offered his business cards to everybody on the way out. And the result of that was that it stayed in the media for three extra days.
Right.
It was on CNN and MSNBC, all kinds of...
And here's where this is the result you want, because the story is now prolonged, and now the U.S. Chamber has to show their hand. They have to actually show their... Explain how that works.
Yeah.
Why that's the end result, what you're looking for.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, he did us such a great favor. The thing you really want is to get your opponent to attack you back, because it just looks really stupid if your opponent is incredibly powerful, like the U.S. Chamber. Right. We only ever go after really, really powerful entities that could squash us,
right?
You would think.
Now, of course, the king of this is the Dow stunt.
Mm-hmm.
Where, first of all, explain, how in the heck did you get on the BBC? That is, I still can't believe that.
Yeah.
I've seen it, and I can't believe it.
Well, first of all, we give away all our secrets, how to get invited to conferences, how to get on TV, how we've done it, at least, how to set up a press conference on our website, thesmen.org. So if you want practical advice on it, go visit our website. But basically, in that case, we just set up a website for Dow Chemical Corporation and got it into search engines, similarly. In this case, it was by sending out a press release for Dow in 2002, kind of making fun of Dow from their position. It got into search engines, and then a week before the 20th anniversary of the Bhopal catastrophe, we get this email from the BBC, as you said, saying, you know, an audience of 300 million people is waiting to hear what Dow Chemical has to say. And so we went and...
What are you thinking at that point?
Well, you freak out. Yeah, you completely freak out. You have a lot to drink. You call up anybody you know who knows anything about anything, especially Bhopal. And in this case, this was a friend of ours from Greenpeace who had suggested the whole idea in the beginning. And Jillo. And we said, help, we just got an email from the BBC. It looks like it's real. It looks like it might not be a trap. And we just consulted for a few hours and came up with a plan, re-examined it a few times, and then just went with it. And the plan was to take full responsibility on behalf of Dow for the Bhopal catastrophe, which is what they have, you know, it's the only ethical or moral thing for them to do. So everybody was overjoyed when they heard this news, except the stock market.
Ooh. $2 billion in 20 minutes.
Yeah, and I heard somebody cheer when you related that story, but it's really dire, you know, that a company does the right thing and gets punished by the stock market.
What does that tell you when that happened? When you saw that happen, what does that tell you?
The stock market is bad. I mean, it's bad to let money rule our political decisions, our decisions, period, our direction as a society. And that's what's happened. I mean, a company like Dow should not be able to kill 20,000 people, which is the number that's estimated to have died since 1984 in Bhopal because of the disaster. We should not allow a company like that to get away with that. There should be capital punishment in such a case. They had a poorly maintained factory there. They had the same factory in Virginia that didn't have any problems. That's just criminal. And when you have a system that rewards companies for that kind of behavior and punishes them when they seemingly do the right thing about it and try to make amends, then you know our system is really, really screwed up.
And a lot of the stuff you talk about in the movie and elsewhere is that there is a need for more government regulation. Mm. Much of the problem are rooted in the deregulation of our economy and government. And that's the same thing here.
Yeah, there's a need for more laws of a certain sort, fewer laws of another sort. You know, it's the only thing that we've got is law. Mm. And that's the only way to actually make sure that corporations don't do what we don't want them to do or, you know, don't destroy the planet, for example.
When you were on the BBC, in the moments before, it's a beautiful scene in the movie where you really see this guy's nervous.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a really gutsy, ballsy thing. Can we say the ballsy?
Mm-hmm.
But you're sitting there, you're cracking your knuckles, you're sweating a little bit. Yeah. What are you thinking about at that moment?
Just freaking out. You know, just as you might expect. It's an extreme sport, adrenaline rushing. It's cheap as sports go. But it's really terrifying. But then as soon as I started speaking, I remember just not being nervous at all. It's this weird thing that happens. Like in that case, as well as when I've been on stage at a conference, it's just as soon as you start speaking, it's not nerve-wracking at all. And there's this weird effect that happens where the audience believing you makes you forget that you're a fake.
So you look into the crowd and you can feel that people are buying what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're just sitting there looking at you and, yeah, you're Exxon or Halliburton or whoever.
Maybe the Halliburton stunt was good. Tell us about some people who come up to you afterwards. Like, you'll go to a conference and you'll propose something absolutely ludicrous, and then people come up to you afterwards and kind of, you know, want to give you their business card and talk to you and find out more about that. Tell us about an example of
Well, that Halliburton one, yeah. We proposed as Halliburton to a catastrophic loss insurance conference on the U.S. Gulf Coast. We proposed to these insurance people in the room a device to save the wealthiest of the wealthy from climate catastrophe, basically by means of giant spherical grub suits, basically these ball inflatable 6-foot balls with little legs that you could put on, and your little head would stick out in the middle. We invited a couple of the people, the insurance people at the conference, to wear them. I wore a third one. And so there we were, the three of us waddling around in front of the room, you know, touching feelers and stuff, while Mike was explaining how they worked and showing animations of these things falling out of buildings and going through fire and draining the life force from animals, really graphically. Just ridiculous. Like, you can't imagine a stupider presentation. And we ended, asked for questions, and the first question was, will it work against terrorism? And there were no other real questions. There was a question about how much it would cost.
So nobody said, this is lunacy. Nobody disputed it. They just kind of...
Yeah. Well, one guy came up to us afterwards and asked us if we made a living this way. He totally got it. But everybody else in the room just bought it.
It's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
That's scary.
Yeah, it is scary. Speaking of making a living, you've made the movie and this, but you also are a teacher and you teach at the...
I teach at the New School.
In New York City.
In New York, yeah.
And Mike?
Mike teaches at the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in upstate New York.
And what do you teach there?
I teach mostly, these days, activism and how to do this sort of thing. Because, I'm having my students right now, we're doing a project, actually. I can't tell you a thing about it, but it's a very funny project. And you know, I find they just take to it and get it. It's there's nothing really special about this. It's a bag of tricks. Just dip in and, you know, do it.
When you say it's anybody can do it, but that's, I mean, going up...
Well, if you want to. Yeah, anybody wants to.
Yeah. What would you... how do you get over the fear factor?
Peer pressure and alcohol helps. Yeah. You just kind of, you know,
so
you get together
with
some friends. Yeah.
Peer pressure and alcohol. That's
No, it works for a lot of things. And in this case, you know, you get together with people who... feel like you do, who maybe have a similar mischief streak, and you come up with ideas and then tell each other that it's reasonable to do them.
Can you walk us through how you came up with an idea? Walk us through the entire process.
Often it's by accident. Often we want to just do one thing and we end up doing another thing, like with the website for the WTO. In one case, as we were making this movie, as we were, you know, the stock fell, the Dow stock value fell, and we started thinking that was a really important lesson in what happens if you just let money rule what happens. And we thought, what's the worst thing that can happen if you just let corporations decide what to do and you let big money decide what to do? And we thought, well, maybe it's climate change. The end of civilization, conceivably. So we start getting really interested in that, and we decided we would pose as Exxon and crash an oil conference in Calgary, Alberta. We were actually invited to Calgary by an activist group there called the Arusha Center, and together with them, we came up with this idea to crash this big oil conference as Exxon, and we just plotted what to do. Would we come out and say Exxon was going to do the right thing, or would we not? Eventually, we came up with the kind of accurate version of what they're about. Their solution to climate change, which was to announce basically that we would turn all the victims of climate change into fuel. There are already 300,000 victims of climate change every year, according to the World Health Organization. There could be a lot more than that. Market figures out what to do with things. It would figure out what to do with that. So then we passed out these candles that stunk, and
the human hair candles
that you mentioned earlier. Showed a video of the guy who was represented by the candles announcing that he was glad to be part of this program. And as the people were holding them, he said, I'm glad to be part of this program, and I'd like to be turned into a candle. And then they realized what was up. So as we were coming up with as we were coming up with this action, we were just thinking, okay, what's the most disgusting thing we can do that remains accurate, that actually communicates what Exxon is about and what these big companies, these big oil companies in general are about?
Let's talk politics a little bit. Was it 2 weeks after President Obama was elected, you were part of a group of activists who got together and printed a fake New York Times, just like the New York Times, except it said had sort of headlines from 6 months in the future, kind of your dream New York Times. It said Iraq war ended and that. And you distributed, how many copies was it?
Well, it depends 80? Who you asked. Yeah. If you asked the media, it was a million copies.
A million copies, yeah. Yes.
It was 80,000.
80,000, yeah. Okay. Now, I want to ask you, like, what President Obama was candidate Obama, he said, quote, "I'm in this race to tell the corporate lobbyists that their days of setting the agenda in Washington are over. I've done more than any other candidate in this race to take on lobbyists and won. They've not funded my campaign, they will not run my White House, and they will not drown out the voices of the American people when I'm president." Is he keeping his campaign pledge?
Well, we haven't kept ours, you know. I don't know. But when there was this vast movement to elect Obama that was successful, that movement really should have stuck with it and applied pressure to Obama. And I think he knew that he needed that. And a lot of people were trying to communicate that message, that getting somebody elected isn't enough. You actually have to apply pressure to them once they're elected. And, you know, civil disobedience is actually a missing ingredient of democracy. I mean, it's one of the core key ingredients of democracy. It's the way things have changed. It's the way any most real progress has happened in American history. And that kind of pressure, you know, like non-civil disobedience or civil disobedience pressure was what was called for. That hasn't happened. So it's really we who haven't kept our promises. And, yeah, that's what the New York Times was about. We published it with a lot of people a week after the election, assuming that Obama would win. And it was postdated 6 months into the future and showed the world that could be if that pressure were maintained. So in each article, like the headline was Iraq War Ends. There was national health care for everyone. Free healthcare for everyone. There was free higher education. There were a lot of visions that people could get behind. And in each case, those future visions happened because people had taken to the streets and made them happen, applied the pressure to Obama to enable him to be that president.
But that movement has failed in the last year.
Well, it's just it didn't. That pressure didn't continue past the election. Mm.
What do you think of the Tea Party movement? Here's a group that claims to be a populist movement of sorts. They're very anti-government, of course, very anti-tax. Do you find yourself simpatico with them in any way?
No.
No. What do you think about them?
I don't think they're actually populist, are they? I mean, they're organized. They're highly organized, I think. I mean, honestly, I haven't been that curious, yeah. It's interesting, but yeah.
Now the out front,
I'm just intrigued by the name Dick Army. I think it's just perfect for the guy who's behind
it's
an, this.
It's a visual. It's definitely
so
a visual.
Great.
Yeah. The outside, when people walked in here today, they offered. They said, "Who would your target, like your next target for the Yes Men, like to be?" And there's all sorts of folks out there. Sarah Palin. There was Fox News. Someone put the Commonwealth Club, who's on your what CEO corporation government organization? Who would you like to take down next?
Yeah, I saw those names of corporations and people out there, and what I think people who signed that didn't realize was that was actually a contract, and they were actually pledging to go after those targets themselves. And, you know, yeah, people come up to us all the time and say, you should go after X, you should go after Y. And I just always say, well, actually, you should. And, if you're interested in going after Sarah Palin or whoever, we give away our secrets. It's on the yesmen.org. We're also starting this thing called the Yes Lab that you mentioned, where we're working with organizations to help further their strategic aims. So organizations that want to go after a particular issue will brainstorm with them how to apply some of the techniques that we've come up with. We'll brainstorm ideas because some ideas may not have anything to do with anything we've done before. It's important to always just, you know, think of the best solution for an issue. And we've already started doing this. So in the months ahead, you may see a profusion of projects.
Okay. Oh. And because at the end of your movie, that's what you it's kind of a call to action at the end of your movie. You're saying, we need, similar to what you said with the Obama, the movement, the people have to do the movement. It's not going to come from top down. It's going to have to come from the streets.
Right. And it's not going to come from a couple of pranksters either.
You need some help.
Yeah. I mean, again, if you look at American history, I think most of the big positive changes have come because people have demanded it, like just not been willing to take no for an answer.
What of the stuff that you've done, what's gotten the most emotional reaction among that you've seen firsthand?
Probably the New York Times.
Really?
Yeah, when people saw that the Iraq War was over, they just almost broke down in tears. Well, some people did break down in tears, actually. And then were bitterly disappointed.
Yeah.
Same with the BBC announcement for the people in Bhopal. The media reported, of course, that people were, you know, devastated.
Yeah, you
that.
Got some blowback on that. You said, well, what about the people in India who heard this news?
Yeah.
I mean, for a couple hours before it was pulled down. And what about them? Did you give them false hope?
Yes. Yes, we did. No, we gave them false certainty. They were certain that they were getting a payout. So it's different. But, you know, they've dealt with 20 years of suffering. I mean, what is an hour of false hopes? And that's fortunately the way they saw it as well.
Because you went to India after that.
Yeah, we went. Knowing that they were happy with what we had done. They were sad. As soon as they saw the result, which was 600 articles in the U.S. press about Dow and Bhopal, that was enough for them.
What results did you see from that, though? You saw you kind of direct the media spotlight a lot, but what did you see that come out of that? I mean, Dow still hasn't pulled their hand in their pocket yet.
No, but they will. You know, these people have been fighting for 25 years now for this, for change, to force Dow to do something, to be accountable. And when they succeed, it'll be a massive global precedent. And that's the way things happen. It's through ongoing pressure over decades. You know, the environmental movement has had a huge effect. Most of the protections that we have against toxic chemicals and against what corporations would otherwise be doing are due to the environmental movement. If it didn't exist, we'd be far worse off than we are. But you can seldom point to any particular act as being responsible for a particular piece of legislation or a particular change. There are exceptions. Like, look up Tim DeChristopher and bitter70.org. He's going to trial very soon, actually, for having walked into an auction of oil and gas leases in Utah, and intending to disrupt it. It was at the tail end of the Bush regime. And he went in intending to start yelling and disrupt this auction of oil and gas leases. Instead, the first thing that happened when he walked in the door was somebody handed him a paddle and said, here you go, you're a bidder, I guess. And he said, oh, yes, I am. And
so he started bidding.
He won 12 leases in a row. The judge finally noticed that something was wrong. This kid in, economics undergraduate student couldn't really be winning all these parcels, and stopped the auction. And then when Obama took office, he canceled it. So single-handedly, this guy saved all this land, hundreds of thousands of acres in Utah. It's rare to see something like that happen.
Right.
Normally, you can draw attention to a thing, you can screw up the system a bit and make people sit up and take notice about things. It's rare to actually have a direct, immediate effect like that.
So how do you measure success of what you've done?
Well, we measure it in mostly in terms of how much press attention we get for important issues, mm-hmm. in a word. That's the goal of the things we do. It's also, with the movie, the goal is to sit people down for an hour and a half and show them something that they might not be out to see. A lot of people go to see our movie because it's funny or because, you know, they've heard a few jokes from it. And then they learn, hopefully, a lot more about the system that's destroying the planet.
What the DVD has a couple of stunts that were not in the movie. What are some? Give us a couple of favorites that didn't make it in that we will see on the DVD.
There's the full BBC broadcast, which goes on for 6 minutes. Pretty unprecedented in broadcast.
That's
TV.
A huge. Three or four times as long as most news reports.
Yeah, and it's like six times as long as you can stand to watch in a movie. And there's a thing in which we posed as Dow Chemical Corporation, went to a nanotechnology conference, and told the scientists there that they should, similarly to Dow Chemical in the 50s and 40s and 50s, they should throw caution to the wind, not worry about the consequences of what they're doing. The post-cautionary principle was the title of the talk. Passed out horse blinders. The scientists would not have it. They did not like this message at all. And they revolt in a really funny way.
I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second because we're going to be taking questions from the audience soon. Now it's your turn to talk to Andy and ask him whatever you want to ask him. And so please start lining up with the microphone right now. There's a microphone right there and a microphone right there. Now, you talk about civil disobedience and the need for that. So often, and you've been in activism for many, many years, I think, and from covering it and talking and knowing activists for years, I think there's a frustration level that if they try a few things and it doesn't work, they get frustrated and leave. What do you say to people who are facing that frustration early in their activism careers?
I think you just have to have fun with it. And, find a way, find what you're passionate about, hook up with people that you like, and do something you enjoy.
And what happens if stuff fails?
Well,
can that work
it all
too?
Fails. I mean, it's you just have to look at the targets. I mean, we're facing people who spend $400,000 a day, for example, on lobbying. There's a disproportionate situation, but it also always succeeds eventually. And we have a lot of, we have an 8-hour day. We have Social Security. We have, we don't have healthcare yet. But we have some things that are good, and they've come out of people demanding them. So, you just have to look at it in the long term and meanwhile have a lot of fun.
Okay, are we ready for questions? All right, let's do it. As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, and tonight we're hosting Andy Birkelbaum, leading member of the Yes Men, and I'm Joe Garofoli, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle and the San Francisco Chronicle Politics blog. Now we will go to the audience for questions. We'll start with you, sir.
You said that when you got the email from BBC, it didn't look like a trap. Has there been a time that you have walked into a trap or have experienced any traps?
No.
No.
It shocks us every time, yeah.
Also, you've never been arrested.
No.
Never been arrested in this stuff.
No, after the human candle thing, the organizers realized that something was up, and after about 15 minutes of deliberation as the presentation went on and then finished, they finally came up and grabbed us and escorted us off the stage and physically grabbed us and took us to a holding cell. It was in the Rodeo Stampede grounds, the largest rodeo grounds in the world in Calgary. And they held us there for about an hour and told us what terrible trouble we were going to be in when the police arrived. And we kept insisting, well, you're going to be in trouble. We're from Exxon. And I mean, we were slightly nervous, but the police finally arrived And then we told them the truth, which is one of the cardinal rules. If you can possibly help it, don't lie to the police. It can get you into trouble. And we just told them what we had done, and they laughed. They brought us tea, and they said to hold on. We'll take care of this. And they went to talk to the organizers, calm them down. And the organizers wouldn't be calmed down. So 20 minutes later, the cops returned shamefacedly with trespassing tickets and told us, you know, they had to give them to us, but we didn't really have to pay them. So, yeah. After that, we actually tried to make the tickets stick, and we tried to go to court. We had a lawyer offer her services at a talk the next day and say, yeah, we're going to take this to court. You're going to go up on trial for trespassing. And the court threw it out before it could get there, unfortunately.
And the only real trouble you're in, sort of trouble, is that the U.S. Chamber, where you had that whole dust-up, they're suing you for what? Copyright infringement because of your...
Trademark infringement.
Trademark infringement, yeah.
I think. Yeah, I can't actually read through the entire case, but it's, yeah, it's something, but it's hilarious. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is based here in San Francisco, is defending us, yay. And they're fantastic, and you can visit EFF.org, find the case, and the top document on the case is hilarious to read. It's a short rebuttal by the EFF and Davis Wright Tremaine, who are also defending us.
Your attorneys. Yeah. Sir, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Mark O'Hara, and it's just great to be here. It's very ironic that I came up tonight from Palo Alto. I'm used to live here, a local entertainer. I was fronting this band called Super Booty for a number of years. And all my protests were musical, you know. Mm-hmm. That was kind of my way of protesting, is by doing something ridiculous with music. But in 1999, I decided to run for mayor against Willie Brown because I heard that he was running unopposed, that no one was going to, you know, try to contest him, which was very naive on my part. But anyway, I decided to go with the booty party, and that was going to be my party, and got 1,000 votes, got on the ballot and all that. And the Reform Party found me, and they backed my campaign and raised all this money, and it started out as this ridiculous joke, right, and then turned into this thing.
So, Mark, what's your question for...
Yeah, my question is, the funny part about all this is that I haven't done anything since. That was like 10 years ago, but I've been very frustrated lately. And a few days ago, I started on television, they were talking about the Tea Party, and I said, I had a Freudian slip, and I said, I hate the Pea Party. And I went, you know, 10 light bulbs went off. I was like, gosh, I wonder if there's like a Pea Party out there to mock the Tea Party, right? Mm. And I went online, and there wasn't anything. You know, I just couldn't believe it. So I quickly put a website together, and it actually launched today. And I was just wondering if you could help me out. And also, my other question is how can you not laugh during some of these key moments? I mean, I just don't know how you couldn't burst out laughing.
Yeah. Well, in answer to the first question, it doesn't sound like you need any help.
Well, who knows?
Great.
Run a mayoral campaign.
From,
yeah.
Hello.
Well, that was just...
That's more than I could do.
That was just
do.
Pure luck.
Yeah, well, but the how you keep from laughing, you just don't. You just don't laugh. It's very serious. Also, this weird thing happens with the audience where you end up believing that you are the real thing. You know, they're all sitting there believing that you're from Exxon, and you end up forgetting that you're not. And you also forget that it's funny what you're doing. And even if you don't, even if you crack a smile or start giggling or whatever, you know, it's the guy from Exxon who's giggling, so what? You could pee your pants.
Yeah, well, if you want to check it out, peaparty.org if you want to help out. Maybe I'll email you.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Andy@theyesmen.org.
Sir, what's your question for Andy?
Corporations are one of your favorite targets, but aren't governments equally to blame? For example, governments could charge polluters for the damage they do. Or in India, people should be able to sue for damages. Something's wrong with their legal system. So aren't governments just as liable as corporations?
Oh, yeah. Only governments are liable, I think. Only we are liable, and government is our representative. So, yeah, corporations are just machines to make money. That's all they are. And the fact that they do terrible things is our fault. We're just not controlling them. So, yeah, you can't say Dow is terrible to not care about killing 20,000 people in India because they're allowed to, and all they're allowed to be about is making money. So it's our responsibility. Yeah, we are to blame.
Thank you.
Sir, question for Andy.
Yeah, I've been a fan of yours since I first saw your first film, and I'd just like to thank you for all you do. But What I'm curious about is that it seems to me that the word is getting out about yes men, and people are getting in corporations, perhaps getting more aware of you and more suspicious. And I'm just wondering what you think, how much farther you think yes men can go, and what's the evolution of yes men from here?
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, people, we do get recognized when we do these things. The last three events in the movie, some people in the audience actually got it. Only in one case did they do anything about it. But in a couple of the others, they came up afterwards and said, that was hilarious, and can we have a DVD? So, you know, it hasn't really gotten in the way. Conference organizers probably aren't our main audience. And there's so many of them. There's so many thousands of these sham conferences that, you know, the sky's the limit. But that said, we're not very many people. And so that's why we're launching this Yes Lab, to brainstorm with activists projects that can work for them and us as well, and all of us. So we're just trying to spread the wealth, spread the what we've learned, whatever that is, and give away our techniques as much as possible so that other people do them. Yep.
Go ahead. Question for Andy.
Hi, I'm Kimberly Schroeder, and I actually saw you guys in Copenhagen when I was there at the UN Climate Change Convention. Oh, cool. So I'm part of the International Youth Climate Movement. And basically, well, one question would be, do you think that you've been able to do a lot of these stunts because of your age, gender, skin color, that sort of thing, and younger people or people more a more diverse group of people wouldn't be able to do the same kinds of actions that you're doing? So how could the international youth climate movement sort of pull off, if not the same stunts, you know, other stunts or meaningful actions as well, and just getting the youth climate movement involved in this sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. And Andy, well, could you do a quick review of what you did in Copenhagen?
Yeah. Well, some of the things that we do, age does help, you know, the Exxon representative, it's better when he's a bit older or she's a bit older. But I think if it were somebody your age, that would be fine too. Exxon sending a young representative, why not? A lot of young people work for Exxon, I think. But there's also a lot of things that we've done that doesn't involve getting up on TV or in front of an audience, like publishing a fake New York Times, or in Copenhagen, actually, what you mentioned, nobody appeared physically in that. We just sent out a flurry of press releases on behalf of the Canadian government. It actually came out of a youth group in Canada, the idea for it. Leading up to the Copenhagen conference, the Canadian youth delegation wanted to embarrass Canada, their government, over Canada's terrible climate stance. We always thought they were really nice people up there, but they're not. they've got, you know, the single most polluting site on Earth, CO2 emitting site, the tar sands. They were one of the main forces hobbling the climate treaty that didn't happen. And to embarrass Canada, we together came up with this elaborate plan that worked, to send out a flurry of press releases, each one more ridiculous than the last. And reporters couldn't tell which ones were right, which ones were fake, and it all got very muddy, with the end result that Canada stumbled all over itself, despite having set up a war room to deal with activists. It didn't work. The spokesperson for the prime minister ended up accusing an NGO of having done it, this group Equiterre. He just started yelling at the head of Equiterre in the hallway at one point, saying, you shouldn't have done that. And Equiterre is like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. Got a lot of play in Canada. The spokesperson was fired the next day. That and a couple other incidents really worked. And nobody had to appear and represent anything. It was all just press releases. So there's always ways to do things. It's just a matter of coming up with things to do.
So do you think there's a role for international collaboration, like using these like the International Youth Climate Movement or other existing groups, or just furthering that, those connections and sort of having, I mean, I don't know, can we coordinate press releases across multiple countries? Can we do something? I mean,
yeah,
along those lines? Okay.
Definitely. Let's talk.
All right. All right. Thanks.
And that's how it starts.
Yep.
Sir, question for Andy.
It seems like the big idea to disrupt a system is to know the rules and then invert them. And a lot of your arenas have been the media, but have you actually gone outside of organizations, but have you gone inside of organizations and done this? Disrupt the system within. In other words, you could fake being part of a department or...
Well, I'm a professor at a school, and they think I really am one. But besides that, no.
But it just seems like another way of going about it.
Yeah. Well, I guess when I was doing computer programming, everybody thought I was a computer programmer. Right. And I worked for whoever one works for when one is a computer programmer. But, and I think we're all kind of like that. You know, we're all in these jobs, and we don't necessarily agree with what our employers are doing. Hopefully we remain awake enough to realize that their interests don't align with ours. I think a lot of people do. But yeah, no. We haven't purposely gone into the corporate world, for example, and taken a job just to do something from the inside. But why not? It's a good idea.
Sir, for Andy.
Back again, yes. When you were talking on BBC World about the you were misrepresenting Dow Chemical Company, the journalist who was interviewing you, he seemed to be rather indignant about what Dow Chemical had done. You appeared on the show on in front of the same journalist shortly afterwards, representing Yes Men. And he seemed even more indignant. And I was just wondering, was he really that indignant? Or after the camera stopped rolling, did his attitude change towards you? Or what happened after?
Well, it was actually two different journalists. The one that interviewed me on the BBC was for the BBC. The other one was Channel 4. I think in the movie we blur that a little bit because it's too complicated. But yeah, the BBC one was indignant that Dow hadn't done anything until then. He was like, "Wow, isn't it? It's about time you've done this. Why did you wait 3 years since buying Union Carbide to finally put their injustices behind them?" But you know, he was very happy about hearing this news. He knew it was a real, you know, unprecedented sort of thing. And in fact, at one point, in the interview, I say, you know, in reaction to his accusation that we've waited too long, I say, well, you know, this is the first time in history that a publicly owned company has done the right thing just because it's right. This has never happened before. And I could have said, you know, this isn't happening now. But the other reporter was indignant because... you know, well, the false hopes thing. He thought that we'd created bitter, bitter disappointment in Bhopal among activists. And, you know, that was in... He was another English reporter for Channel 4. And in the UK, it just didn't make much sense as an action because the BBC was covering it, Channel 4 was covering it, the 20th anniversary was all over the media. It was really an action intended for US audiences. Dow is a U.S. company, and yet a lot of people in the U.S. still don't know what Bhopal was or what Dow's role in that was. So it was really intended for the U.S. And in the U.S., the media never talked about the false hopes because they had to explain what Bhopal was and why Dow was responsible. So it really worked for that.
And I'd like to put the question to our host as well. And how would you, as you're a journalist, and how would you feel? If Andy had fooled you, you'd written the story, and then you know it emerged it was a hoax. And how would you feel about it?
No, that's what I was going to add is that I think part of those feelings from the journalists was they're ticked off at you because they got rooked, and so that's you would feel that way. And but a lot of the stuff is kind of basic journalism. If someone sends you a press release, you want to make sure that person actually
represents that company.
They might be worn down from getting so many fake press releases all the time. I mean, there's this giant PR industry.
Right.
You know, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars spent fooling the media, sending out hoax press releases about, you know, the healthiness of cigarettes or whatever. Not anymore, but that used to be the case.
Right. Officially fooling the media.
Officially fooling the media and never revealing the hoax.
Right.
You know, so there was a period when Tony Blair's absurd statement that Saddam Hussein's bombs could reach London in 45 minutes were reported, and they were never revealed to be a hoax. Yep. You know, that was never revealed to be fake. I mean, he's not a corporation, but you get the idea.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. Oh, you have a question. Okay, great.
Are there any criticisms about your work that you've heard that are particularly salient, have hit home, or that you've considered?
That's a tough question.
And what were they?
Well, let's see. We've heard criticisms that we're not taking to the streets. We're not getting arrested enough, for example. We've only been arrested a couple of times. Not for any of these actions. Was arrested once by accident while doing an action, but it was because I had a bicycle ticket outstanding. Another criticism is that it's not really, that it's kind of hit or miss. It's not always changing things directly. I think the best thing you can do is through the political system or the legal system, actually get out there and rewrite laws or, you know, take to the streets and demand that certain laws be rewritten or go into politics, become mayor of San Francisco. There's a lot of things that you can do that are more worthwhile than what we do. But we're doing the best we can, and we're kind of sort of good at it. We can do it. So,
question for Andy.
I have a very simple question. I just wondered how you came to choose the name or be known as the Yes Men.
It was when we received this accidental invitation from the World Trade Organization. The first thing we did after thousands of protesters were headed to Seattle, we set up this fake site. And when we got the first accidental invitation to this fake WTO site and accepted the invitation, we debated what to do. Like, would we go to this conference and get on stage and then start yelling about, you know, terrible trade policies? And, you know, that could have been interesting to do. We decided instead to just play it to the hilt, play the WTO as far as we could, talk about privatizing democracy, abolishing the siesta, all kinds of, you know, great ideas, great free market ideas, as great as we could. And so we were just going to say yes as loudly as we could instead of no and see what happened. And, you know, also it's a commentary on how we're all yes men when and we've got to say no. You know, we can't be yes men.
Okay,
I just have one quick question. Is that all right? Short?
Really short. Short.
Just with, you know, the thing I'm up to, this Pea Party thing. What I'm wondering now is, and you talked about fear earlier, you know, and I'm really wondering now if I should be, like, if I'm in danger by doing this, because these Tea Partiers have been, you know, threatening people with...
I don't think so. I think you're fine. Yeah.
I'll put that on the site.
Yeah.
Okay. So before we end tonight's program, it is a newly founded Inforum tradition to ask all the speakers, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Oh, rats.
We're on the clock.
I've already said it. Take to the streets and demand change. Figure out what change should look like. I think we've already done that. And make it happen. That would do it. How much longer do I have?
So you got 35 more seconds.
Oh, jeez.
You don't have to fill the
time.
Do it twice.
Do it three times. Do it four times. Do it five times. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we got the New Deal this way. You know, Roosevelt didn't want to give workers what he ended up giving them.
Look how long it took to get health care.
Yeah.
Or some version of it. Yeah. Still waiting, perhaps.
Another few years.
Yeah. Let's thank Andy for being here tonight, for sharing his opinion with us. Thank you. And now the very cool gavel part.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.